And finally, this hour, we take you to a performance space in Los Angeles. It looks like any other comedy club, but there is a difference. It's called UnCabaret, and this year marks its 25th anniversary. As NPR's Art Silverman tells us, audiences come not to hear the usual slick routines, but real stories with very personal punchlines.
A lot of stand-up in L.A. is really just a chance for comics to audition for parts in TV or movies. UnCabaret is a place to hear unvarnished, rough-edged ideas being tried out, mostly for the first and possibly only time, like this one about going to a yoga class.
So I go in, and there's 80 people in this class. It's the biggest class I've ever seen, and it's a wall of mirrors.
That's Michael Patrick King. He's one of the people who helped create Sex in the City and Two Broke Girls.
And the woman, who is the teacher with the Madonna headset, says to the class of 80 people, everybody should focus on themselves. And I was like, I can do this. I have been doing this for a long time.
I took her to see a movie in a graveyard. Oh.
And this is comedian, writer, and actor Patton Oswalt. He's known for a role in the sitcom The King of Queens and the movie Young Adult. At UnCabaret, he told a tale about a date that changed his life.
And it was almost like me kind of saying bye-bye to the whole nerd world. It was so symbolic of, like, I'm going to go see the 10th victim in a graveyard and then just kind of leave that life behind. Like, I'm so unnerded now. Like,
I can play you another dozen examples of people whose names you know who have performed at UnCabaret. Judd Apatow, Julia Sweeney, Sandra Bernhardt, Roseanne Barr, many others. Behind this peculiar place is a woman named Beth Lapidus. She started out as a performance artist.
And I had sort of a spiritual awakening where I thought I could do exactly what I do but make it funny, and being funny is a higher calling. It's a higher purpose.
So she left the avant-garde stage for comedy clubs. And while she loved getting laughs there, traditional comedy clubs had a downside for her.
I was shocked immediately in the comedy clubs by how old-fashioned it seemed. I was shocked that people were doing jokes about how men and women are different. I was shocked that people were doing shticky stuff that just seems so old-fashioned to me. There was no other way of saying it.
In reaction to that, she created her own comedy club. It operated without the old rules. It brought in funny people from the huge Hollywood talent pool who had day jobs writing for movies and TV, and it freed them to talk about their own lives. Beth Lapidus tells her performers to reveal things they'd share with a close friend, and she has another instruction.
When you get on stage, do the material that if you don't do it, your head is going to explode.
My grandfather is a minister, or was a minister before he died. He was a minister of this Korean church, and we would go out to restaurants, to family-style restaurants, and there'd be like 10 of us, and we'd be sitting at a table, and my grandfather would be praying.
This embarrassing really childhood story by comedian Margaret Cho.
And he's praying. You know, and it's so embarrassing. And then the waiter's just standing there like, who had the Rudy Tooty fresh and fruity?
For writer-director Larry Charles, his UnCabaret horror tale came from his professional life. He's a veteran of Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. He also directed one hit movie, Borat, and another one that, well, didn't do as well.
I made this movie with Bob Dylan called Mass Anonymous. It's gotten some very interesting reactions. Variety called it the height of masturbatory hubris. I really, you know, it's like the headlines, bombs away. I mean, I've gotten a lot of that kind of stuff. Larry Charles is a complete idiot. There's a lot of stuff like that.
Painful experience plus time. Well, that's exactly what comedy is. And I should make clear, UnCabaret is not tailored to everyone's taste. Stories can drag on way too long. Jokes can be few or obscure. And at times, you can be baffled as to whether you are supposed to laugh at all. An example from writer and sometimes public radio contributor Tig Notaro.
Oh my gosh, I know it might seem a little weird to just right out of the gate start with a punchline, but my mother died tragically. Thank you so much for coming out. You guys are such a great audience.
But after a quarter century, audiences still come to gamble that they'll be rewarded at UnCabaret. And now, if you can't make it to L.A., you can watch UnCabaret online. Remember, though, watching videos of UnCabaret performances robs you of an important part of the experience, a chance to add your own laughter to the show.
After my mother died, Thank you so much for coming out. You guys are such a great audience.
Art Silverman, NPR News.
The long-awaited day has almost arrived for fans of Arrested Development. This weekend, Netflix is releasing new episodes of the beloved but canceled sitcom. It's an unusual arrangement, but as NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, the show is just the latest example of old media riding its fan base to new media shores.
Arrested Development is about a family business that dabbles in frozen bananas, poorly constructed McMansions, and light treason.
Dad sold houses to the Iraqis, didn't he? And this is what you kept from me so I could take the polygraph test. Tell me the truth, okay? Because there's been a lot of lying in this family.
And a lot of love.
Arrested Development started airing 10 years ago and lasted 3 seasons on Fox. It's built its audience after getting canceled, with DVDs and streaming video. Netflix looked at its passionate fan base and picked up the show for a 4th season. The show's an old media brand with a following that would not have been possible without promotion and distribution from big studios and networks. That value translates to new media. When the band Radiohead was signed to a major label, it developed a huge fan base. It turned to those fans when it produced an independent album in 2007. Fans could pay whatever they wanted to buy the album online. In Rainbows was a hit. If you made a list of old established media brands rocking new media platforms, comedian Louis C.K. would be near the top. He's old media, with his HBO specials and TV shows. But he sold his last concert video directly to fans online. They paid $5. He made more than $1 million. Or look at the people behind the TV drama Veronica Mars, about a teenage detective.
You're not a killer, Veronica.
They used Kickstarter to successfully raise money for a Veronica Mars movie. Musician Amanda Palmer turned to Kickstarter, too. She was signed to a major label. Her Kickstarter campaign for an upcoming album was so successful, she gave a TED Talk about it.
And the goal was $100,000. My fans backed me at nearly $1.2 million, which was the biggest music crowdfunding project to date.
These brands' fans give them an advantage over up-and-comers, says analyst Michael Pachter.
It's easier to produce something that already has an audience than to sell something that has no audience, that's brand new to everybody.
Most of these artists bringing their old media fan base into new media projects tend to be mid-list acts, not blockbuster celebrities, says author Grady Hendrix. But their name recognition means they can do what a little act could never pull off.
Some band from Cleveland that has a small following looking to get Kickstarter funds for their album.
While old media brands outshine new media hopefuls, that doesn't mean they always understand the new terrain. Look, says Hendrix, at the unfortunate Kickstarter page created by actress Melissa Joan Hart. She starred in shows like Sabrina, the Teenage Witch.
Oh, sorry, is this the Witch's Council?
Hart hopes fans today will donate to help her produce a romantic comedy she wrote herself. But the page feels like it was written by a publicist's intern, says Hendrix. It's soulless, impersonal, bland.
And it's raised something like, you know, $50,000, and it's really doing badly.
On the other hand, actor Zach Braff started a Kickstarter with a video that oozes kinship with fans. He wants to make a follow-up to an earlier film he wrote and directed, Garden State.
There are shots of him and his brother and all this behind-the-scenes things.
I wrote Garden State about a time in my life when I was feeling overwhelmed and lost in my 20s. I guess you could say Wish I Was Here is about the next chapter of your life in your 30s.
And you feel like, hey, Zach Braff is going to, like, answer my emails.
It's that sense of ownership and connection that leads people to donate money to movies that'll ultimately benefit the major studios that make them, says Hendrix, like Warner Brothers and Veronica Mars.
Even though it raised twice what its stated goal was, I mean, I think it raised $5 million instead of $2 million, which was what its goal on Kickstarter was, that's roughly the budget they were looking for what they want to do. But obviously, there are going to be other costs, and Warner Brothers is going to make up the difference.
Hendrix says many of these new media projects still depend on serious old media buy-in. Rumors are swirling now about the fate of one popular but canceled science fiction show.
That Heroes is going to be resurrected by Microsoft as an Xbox exclusive, and the only way you're going to be able to watch it is on Xbox.
Giving fans hope for new Xbox or Netflix episodes of their canceled darlings, like Caprica, Chuck, and Firefly. Netta Ulaby, NPR News. We'll be right back.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. A man who's been called the most powerful artist in the world is trying his hand at rock stardom. The dissident Chinese artist Ai Weiwei has made a music video. It's inspired by the 81 days he spent in detention in 2011. NPR's Louisa Lim met him this morning in Beijing.
The video shows Ai Weiwei sitting in a chair, a black hood over his head. Written on it are the words suspected criminal. As he paces the cell, two guards pace with him. As he sleeps, they stand by his bed. This dissolves into the fantasies of the prison guards, ending with Ai, head shaved, dancing in drag. It's a dystopian nightmare, and that's the point.
At least you shared my nightmares, and I had a terrible nightmares after I was released. But think about so many political prisoners. They're still in jail. So I make my music to give to them.
Ai's voice is angry, the lyrics too explicit to translate. He compares China to a prostitute. Even the song's title is intentionally confrontational. Ai Weiwei explains the choice of name.
Dumbass. We call somebody who still have an illusion about this political condition and have an illusion to think there's possibility to make some kind of change. I think the system itself refuses to make any kind of change.
As he taps away incessantly on Twitter, Ai Weiwei seems to be a global brand. In person, he cannot leave Beijing, having had his passport taken away. But he has one exhibition in Indianapolis, another piece in Hong Kong. Three projects are coming up in the Venice Biennale, as well as a travelling exhibition heading for Princeton, Cleveland and Miami. He's in this month's Playboy magazine. There's a documentary about him, a book about his arrest, and recently in London, a play was staged about his ordeal.
You have to admit the crimes.
But it's not a court. I haven't been charged. Why do I have to admit?
You have to. Trust me.
If you don't, you'll never see us again. You'll never come back.
Speaking to the BBC, playwright Howard Brenton said the play was Ai Weiwei's own idea.
I mean, we are part of his project, really. Ai Weiwei's work is like stones being thrown into the a pond. The ripples, sort of like shock waves, get everywhere.
So what is his project anyway? I asked Ai Weiwei.
My project is very simple. It's the freedom.
He may not be able to sing in tune, but this, he believes, is the sound of freedom. Ai Weiwei believes every citizen with a voice should use it. And courage is not something to sacrifice. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
This Sunday on HBO, director Steven Soderbergh presents his new film, Behind the Candelabra, a showbiz love story about Las Vegas entertainer Liberace, played by Michael Douglas, and his relationship with a much younger boyfriend, played by Matt Damon. They kept their relationship secret from the public. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, has this review.
Before you see any of Behind the Candelabra, when you just consider the concept of the TV movie and its casting, this new HBO film's production raises all sorts of questions. How much will be based on verifiable fact and how much will be fictionalized? On an anything-goes premium cable network such as HBO, how graphic will the sex scenes be? And the most important questions involve the drama's two leading men, playing an ultra-flamboyant piano player and the wide-eyed young man who becomes his behind-the-scenes companion for 5 years. Michael Douglas? Matt Damon? Let's dispense with the biggest curiosity factor, the casting, right away. Behind the Candelabra structures its story quite cleverly, by starting with Damon as shaggy-haired Scott Torson, a farm boy of sorts who works as a dog trainer for Hollywood films, lives with protective older foster parents, and is first shown in 1977 shyly allowing himself to be approached at a bar by another man. Damon Scott is all aw-shucks innocence. And when a friend takes him to Las Vegas to see a Liberace show, it's like taking a trip to Oz. They walk into the Hilton showroom while the performance is in full swing. And so do we, hit immediately and viscerally by the excessive glitz of it all. The gold glass-topped grand piano, Liberace's silver sequin suit and heavily teased hair, and, of course, his carefully rehearsed casual stage patter, with which he entertains the audience while playing piano, sometimes with only one hand. You start the scene watching Michael Douglas, but in seconds, you're carried away, or at least dumbfounded, by Liberace.
A boogie-woogie break. And when I'm playing it and I stop at a certain point, you're going to think that I forgot the music. But I didn't forget the music. There's just no music written for that part. That's why they call it a break.
Yes, it is. And when Scott's friend Bobby, played by Scott Bakula, ushers him backstage after the show to meet the star, young Scott is instantly taken in by the larger-than-life persona he encounters. And so are we, because Michael Douglas, who personified the male libido in Fatal Attraction, commits to the character of Liberace so completely and so convincingly.
Hey, look who's here.
Hello, Bobby.
Hi, Lee. You were fantastic. This is my friend, Scott Thorson. His first time in Las Vegas.
Oh, Lost Babe in the Woods. It's like a Disney movie. A little Bambi. Very nice to meet you.
You were incredible out there.
I'm just a piano player. But everybody did seem to enjoy themselves, didn't they?
From this point on, Behind the Candelabra is pretty much the arc of a showbiz love affair between a Vegas icon and an innocent who gets remade to embody that star's specific fantasies. It's like Elvis and Me, that TV movie about Elvis and Priscilla Presley. Except in this case, it's boy meets boy, boy gets boy, boy loses boy. The script is written by Richard LaGravenaise, who also wrote the scripts for The Fisher King and The Horse Whisperer. And his approach is to underscore the similarities between a gay and a straight relationship, not the differences. So yes, Damon and Douglas share a few love scenes and sex scenes and bubble baths. But nothing in Behind the Candelabra feels gratuitous. And though the behind-the-scenes dialogue shouldn't be taken as gospel, the over-the-top settings and costumes and music are as authentic as possible. The music, in fact, is adapted by Marvin Hamlisch, whose contributions here were his last film work before he died. Director Soderbergh, who worked with Michael Douglas on Traffic and Matt Damon on the Ocean's 11 films and others, does Liberace's story justice on stage and off. And as an extra bonus, he packs the movie with big names playing small roles. Debbie Reynolds as Liberace's mom, Dan Aykroyd as his manager, Rob Lowe as his plastic surgeon, and Paul Reiser as a lawyer. But it's the two central stars who really make Behind the Candelabra work. For Matt Damon, it's a role that shows a different side of him, not full frontal, but emotionally. And for Michael Douglas, after being stricken with cancer, it's about as showy a comeback role as anyone could imagine. And Douglas doesn't just pull it off, he owns it.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne Ribaldonato, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yowei Shaw. John Sheehan directed today's show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.